morning, apparently the president cannot name a prosecutor any way he wants. A judge says the Trump administration improperly named the lawyer who had the president's critics indicted. What happens now? It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Boy Scouts now allow girls, and the head of the military does not like it. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. NPR obtained a draft Pentagon report saying the military should stop working with Scouts for national security reasons. Also, Utah Governor Spencer Cox warns that politics is replacing religion. He drew wide attention by calling for civility after the murder of Charlie Kirk. So how would he address political division now? It's Tuesday, November 25th. The actor John Larroquette is 78 years old today. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. The Pentagon says it's investigating Democratic Senator Mark Kelly of Arizona over possible breaches of military law. Kelly, a former Navy pilot, appeared in a video with several lawmakers calling for troops to defy illegal orders. NPR's Quill Lawrence reports a federal law allows retired service members to be recalled for potential court-martial.
This would be unprecedented, I think. I spoke with military lawyer Kevin Carroll, who's a retired colonel who served in the first Trump administration, and he said the last thing even similar he could think of was in 1925, so 100 years ago, but that was an active duty officer. This is very different, and it seems, Carroll said, to be an attempt to silence political dissent.
NPR's Quill Lawrence reporting, Senator Kelly said he upheld his oath to the Constitution and dismissed the probe as political bullying. A peace plan drafted by the United States and Russia appears to have been scrapped in the Geneva talks to end the war in Ukraine. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reports European leaders are working to revise the proposal, which was widely seen as favoring Russia.
Posting on social media, President Zelensky said the necessary steps to end the war are now workable and a lot of the right things are being taken into account. It's not the first time Ukrainians have anxiously watched Russia try to exert influence over the Trump administration. Businesswoman Ruslana Ponkliv says Ukrainians are fighting a just fight.
I trust Zelensky and I trust in my country and in these people who live in this country, who stay in this country. It's a very strong power, really. People who are not afraid and who be very strong.
She believes Ukraine will win this war in the end. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Kyiv.
Democratic lawmakers held a congressional hearing in Los Angeles on Monday. Steve Futterman reports they heard testimony from people affected by immigration arrests directed by the Trump administration.
Congressman Robert Garcia from California, the House Oversight Committee's top Democrat, led the hearing.
Right now, Donald Trump, Kristi Noem, Tom Holman are causing terror, not just in Los Angeles, but across the country.
Among those testifying was L.A. Mayor Karen Bass, who said the raids are illegal and focused on race.
The raids don't dominate the nightly news, but just about every day, immigrant enforcement actions continue.
Some relate personal experiences. Andrea Velez described how she was apprehended by agents, even though she told them she is a U.S. citizen.
I don't feel safe at all.
Members of the committee said they are establishing a database for people to document their stories. For NPR News, I'm Steve Futterman in Los Angeles.
You're listening to NPR News from Washington. One of the last known survivors of the 1921 Tulsa Race Massacre has died. Viola Ford Fletcher was 111 years old. In recent years, she pushed for justice for the massacre, which destroyed the black community where she grew up. Fletcher was 7 when the attack on what was known as Black Wall Street began. Her family says she died at a Tulsa hospital, surrounded by loved ones. German actor Udo Kier has died. NPR's Andrew Limbong reports he starred in more than 200 movies and was best known for his work in horror.
In the 1970s, Udo Kier starred in 2 movies produced by Andy Warhol, subverting famous horror figures, Flesh for Frankenstein and Blood for Dracula.
You have no reflection!
From there, Kier kicked off a prolific career full of all types of movies, horror, art house, comedy, blockbuster.
I believe very much in small things, not the big acting things.
Here's Kier in a 2021 NPR interview reciting some advice he'd gotten from director Lars von Trier.
His favorite line, don't act. So I try not to act.
According to Variety, Udo Kier died in Palm Springs. He was 81 years old. Andrew Limbong, NPR News.
Civil rights leader Jesse Jackson has been released from a Chicago hospital. A statement from the Rainbow Push Coalition says the 84-year-old was discharged Monday and is in stable condition. Jackson was first diagnosed with Parkinson's disease in 2013. This is NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Fidelity Investments. A dedicated wealth advisor can help build a comprehensive wealth plan. Learn more at fidelity.com/wealth. Investment minimums apply. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC.
Welcome to MN90, Minnesota history in 90 seconds.
In 1979, Martha Rossini Olson pitched an idea for a vendor booth to the Minnesota State Fair. What about soft-serve frozen yogurt? This lower-calorie ice cream alternative was all the rage in the health-conscious atmosphere of the late 1970s, when people were squeezing into short shorts and matching tracksuits and learning how to love jogging and pumping iron at the gym. But nope, the State Fair passed on her idea. It already had a frozen yogurt vendor. Bummer. But Martha put in another pitch, and that one got to go. The trouble was, she and her partners only had 3 weeks until the fair opened. Their idea? Chocolate chip cookies, just like your grandma made. Martha sampled several recipes, took the best ideas, and came up with a soft, gooey, melt-in-your-mouth cookie served in a paper cone. It became the food hit of that year's fair. Sweet Martha's Cookies, now also served in an overflowing bucket, has become the fair's biggest selling vendor and a Minnesota summertime tradition.
MN90 is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities. Made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Online at mn90.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Coming up, when you see a hot social media post about American politics, where in the world did it originate? First, we have some news from a source right here. President Trump's bid to prosecute his critics ran afoul of the law.
A judge threw out the criminal case against former FBI Director James Comey. She did the same for the indictment of Letitia James, the Attorney General of New York State. Both had been indicted by a lawyer who was willing to follow Trump's demand to pursue criminal charges after other prosecutors found no reason for a case. The judge found the lawyer was improperly appointed.
NPR's Kerry Johnson has been following this story. Kerry, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Okay, why was the prosecutor not legitimately in that job?
The judge found the process was invalid, that if the Trump administration wanted to pick a U.S. attorney, it had to go through the right steps. Typically, that would be nomination and confirmation by the Senate. This woman, Lindsay Halligan, has no prior experience as a prosecutor, but she was installed as U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of Virginia. That's one of the most important offices in the country, on orders from President Trump. And she got the job only after the White House forced out a career prosecutor. He expressed doubts about bringing criminal charges against the former FBI Director Jim Comey and New York Attorney General Tish James, both prominent critics of the president who played a role in investigating him.
Okay, so this isn't really a technicality. It's about the limits of executive power and when does the president have to check in with the Senate. In this case, he should have and didn't, according to the judge. But what are the real-world consequences for the cases?
They're pretty serious. This judge, Cameron Curry, wrote, all actions flowing from Lindsay Halligan's defective appointment are unlawful exercises of executive power. They must be set aside. Halligan was, of course, the only prosecutor in the grand jury room for the indictments of Jim Comey and Tish James. She's the only one who signed those indictments. So now both of those cases are dismissed. The Justice Department does have the right to appeal. The White House Press Secretary Caroline Levitt says this is a technical ruling in their view. An appeal will be coming soon. And she says the prosecutor was legally appointed and is extremely qualified. But there's a catch here. The statute of limitations in the Comey case expired at the end of September, and Judge Curry has raised some doubt about whether the DOJ can swing that door back open again.
Letitia James and Jim Comey have got to be pleased about this.
They are, I think. Jim Comey actually released a video saying the case against him was based on malevolence and incompetence. He also praised the Justice Department lawyers who lost their jobs for refusing to indict him.
The message has to be sent that the President of the United States cannot use the Department of Justice to target his political enemies. I don't care what your politics are. You have to see that as fundamentally un-American and a threat to the rule of law that keeps all of us free.
Comey also says he thinks Trump may come after him again, but Comey has faith in the federal courts. And as for Tish James, she says she's heartened and she, quote, remains fearless in the face of these baseless charges. Her lawyer says they're going to challenge any new and politically motivated charges that come against her.
And can you underline for us the larger principle here?
Yeah, so often with President Trump, it involves executive power. Four times this year, different courts have ruled U.S. attorneys have not been appointed legally in places like Nevada, California, New Jersey, and now Virginia. These prosecutors have a lot of power to decide what to investigate, and the president has a lot of power to appoint those prosecutors, but courts are finding that has some limits.
NPR's Carrie Johnson, thanks for your insights, as always.
Happy to do it.
For more on where these cases against James Comey and Letitia James might go from here, we called Kim Whaley. She is a constitutional scholar who teaches law at the University of Baltimore and researches and writes about executive power. Professor Whaley, thanks so much for joining us once again.
Good morning.
So what's your top line reaction to this ruling that the prosecutor in these cases was illegally appointed?
I think it shows the slapdash, goal-oriented way this Justice Department is operating. Prosecutors are supposed to follow the facts to see if a crime is committed. This White House is directing DOJ to target an individual, and because the statute of limitations is about to expire, they did it in a sloppy way that's inconsistent with the rules.
What does this mean for other cases that Lindsey Halligan has brought as U.S. attorney? Are they also likely to be challenged or maybe even dropped?
Yeah, the judge basically said this is the equivalent of pulling some random person off the street and having them go in and secure an indictment. She really went after the core idea that Halligan had any governmental power to do what she did. So under that ruling, any work up as a interim U.S. attorney that Halligan did is invalid and needs to be redone so long as the statute of limitations still allows it.
So the ruling has to do with limits on how long temporary prosecutors can serve. Why does that matter?
Well, under the Constitution, principal officers have to be appointed by the advice and the consent of the Senate unless Congress gives that power to someone else in the government. Here, U.S. attorneys are inferior officers, and so Congress set up a system for vacancies and said Attorney General gets 120 days, and after that, it gets you can extend that by a federal judge. And so the 120 days expired with her predecessor. The government's taking the position that can just go indefinitely, that essentially, Donald Trump can just bypass appointment confirmation by the Senate indefinitely and just keep putting 100 people in for 120 days. The judge said that's not consistent with the Constitution or with the statutory scheme that requires a federal judge to step in.
So the White House says that this is a technicality and it says the Justice Department is going to appeal. What would be the basis for their appeal? Because it would seem that the law is clear here.
Yeah, it's the basis for their appeal is to kind of get around the plain language of the statute, do sort of a tortured argument. Bondi also made this argument that she, quote, ratified it after the fact, that somehow she can step in as attorney general and put some Band-Aids on all the legal problems under the Constitution and the statute. I don't think that's going to fly, but, so long as you lose something, you can appeal. That's the only real standard for an appeal is to be a loser on a particular issue.
But what happens to the indictments against Comey and Letitia James if the appeal is successful? I mean, many people will remember that the statute of limitations in the Comey case was literally at the 12th hour.
Yeah, there's another law that says you can extend for 6 months. There's this grace period if an indictment is dismissed. I think under this ruling, the argument is would be there's no six-month grace period because there was no actual indictment. There was no valid indictment. It's like pulling some, again, the Starbucks barista and asking him to actually do it. That's kind of the problem. For Letitia James, she's within, these alleged crimes are within the statute of limitations. So I expect they'll just go back with a new grand jury and she'll be facing a similar process.
Well, they seem to, both parties seem to suggest that they expected that as well. So, you know, to that end, though, the president has been very vocal in his demand that prosecutors find some way to charge people he does not like, who have criticized him or who he has determined is an enemy. Does this ruling intervene in that in any way?
You know, I don't think so. I mean, it does sort of throw egg on his face and this Justice Department. It's a bit embarrassing for them, but I don't think they're going to make the same mistake twice. I think they're going to make sure that whoever does these things has some legal authority that is stronger in court.
And before we let you go,
so he can still use the Justice Department this way, which is a tragedy, and it's very dangerous for all Americans.
Well, just to that end, I wanted to end where there, you know, the former FBI director in his video responding to these events said, "Look, that this affects everybody. This isn't just about me." Do you agree with that? And if so, why?
I do. I mean, we can't be complacent about this kind of thing. You know, prosecutors at the FBI have powers that regular people do not. They can take your liberty away, and there's even a death penalty under federal law. We don't want people that are in that job picking and choosing winners and losers based on your point of view, based on your politics, based on your religion, who you associate with. And it can trickle down if this is allowed to go forward the way it's arranged right now.
That's Kim Whaley. She's a professor of law at the University of Baltimore. Her most recent book is Pardon Power, How the Pardon System Works and Why. Professor Whaley, thank you.
Great to be with you.
A new feature on X shows where users' accounts are located. NPR's Jeff Brumfield reports.
An account called American, with a bald eagle as its profile pic, was based in Pakistan. Another account called Ivanka Trump News, with over a million followers, was out of Nigeria. Both accounts are now suspended for violating X's rules.
These folks who were pretending to be American culture warriors actually weren't living in the United States at all.
Renee DeResta researches social media at Georgetown University. After X's new location feature rolled out, many accounts that got flagged by other users were influencers on the U.S. political right. But DeResta says mystery accounts appear to be weighing in on other hot-button issues.
There have been some accounts talking about gay rights in Japan that turned out to not be located in Japan, but rather in Brazil.
Sometimes people might have legitimate reasons for hiding their location, like political persecution. But DeResta says she thinks in most cases this is probably about making money. People are exploiting controversy online for clicks, followers, and ultimately cash. She calls it conflict entrepreneurship.
Anytime you have a situation where there is monetizable conflict, you're starting to see these conflict entrepreneurs in the space, and that's what this feature is really illustrating.
Darren Limville co-directs the Media Forensics Hub at Clemson University and spends a lot of time tracking things like Russian-backed influence campaigns. He broadly agrees with DeResta. Many of the accounts look like they're farming rage for cash.
In most of these cases, it's most likely just influencers who are trying to make a buck.
But Linville says some accounts do look like they might be run by foreign governments. For example, some UK accounts calling for Scottish independence. He's long suspected they were set up by Iranian intelligence.
And lo and behold, you look at the account information now and they signed up for X on an Iranian service.
Linville applauds X for adding a little more transparency to who's commenting on the platform. And he says researchers will likely learn more in the days and weeks to come. Jeff Brumfield, NPR News.
This is NPR News. We'll be right back.
KEXE means a lot to people, including our member services manager, Heather Johnson.
Had a little baby. He never stopped screaming for 2 years. He has since substituted that for talking nonstop. But those first...
Shout out to Alex.
Yeah, shout out to Alex. Great kid, terrible baby. There was a lot of screaming, not much sleeping. So the radio was like constantly like my friend. Like, oh my gosh, thank goodness the morning show is on. And, oh, now there's somebody playing great music and everything. And it was just such a relief. And then I was working from home at that point, so I wasn't going into the office and seeing adults anyway. So it was just nice to hear adult voices, you know what was going on in this new town and know what we could do, like what I could take this little screaming thing to.
We need your support now. Go to KEXE.org. I'm Heidi Holton. Thank you for being a part of this community.
R comes from this station and from Bayer. Bayer is dedicated to delivering breakthroughs that save lives and feed the world using the scientific process. Learn more at sciencedelivers.com. From the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. From Fisher Investments, Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. We have some news for you. NPR has learned that Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth plans to stop cooperating with Scouting America, the group formerly called the Boy Scouts. That would break a century-old tradition. Hegseth does not like that the organization has let in girls, among other things. Graham Smith with the NPR Investigations team has been reviewing internal Pentagon documents and joins us now. Graham, good morning.
Good morning.
What are the documents?
Well, there are a number of documents shared by a source with DOD, including a draft report to Congress from Hegseth explaining why the Pentagon won't be supporting next year's Scout Jamboree, which is a gathering of about 15,000 to 20,000 youth and leaders in West Virginia about every 4 years. The military provides logistical and medical support, and we also have memos and draft orders relating to other ways the military is going to cut ties. They're not going to let scout troops meet on military bases anymore, and they'll stop offering incentives that channel a lot of top scouts into military service.
Why do they care?
Well, let's start with the Jamboree. There's a law approved by Congress that requires Pentagon to support it at no cost to scouts, but there's an escape hatch. The secretary can waive support if he determines the effort would be detrimental to national security. He has to provide Congress with a report on why, and that's the first key document we have, a draft of that report. And again, hasn't been delivered to Congress yet, but the draft has Hegseth saying that there's a limited budget, lots of international challenges, and it would harm the U.S. to divert resources to this youth event. But he offers all these other reasons why supporting Scouting hurts America. He says Scouting America promotes DEI, that it rebranded itself to be genderless and attack boy-friendly spaces, and that it strayed from a mission to cultivate masculine values.
Okay, so he doesn't like the adapted mission, and those are the reasons to kick the scouts off of military bases?
Well, that's what they say, and they're going to be kicking them off bases all around the country and all around the world. We reviewed a draft memo to the branches from his office ordering them to...
Oh, the different military branches, right.
Well, yeah, Marines and Army, ordering them to cease all support for Scouting America, saying the organization is no longer a meritocracy, and so their activities will no longer be allowed on bases. Military families we've talked to say this is a huge deal because they get relocated all the time during a career, and it's hard on the kids. They say Scouting is a constant, kind of a home for them, and sometimes the only kid-centric activity outside of school when they end up in Germany or Japan or wherever.
I would also imagine the military involved itself with the Scouts because they could recruit
kids, future soldiers and so forth. How's that come into play?
They do a lot of recruiting among scouts. Scouts who are super motivated and stick with the program eventually can become Eagle Scouts. It's a lot of work, but the military loves this kind of task-oriented, civic-minded kid. From 10 to 20% of the students at the Service Academy are Eagle Scouts, and Eagles who enlist get advanced rank and pay. This would end under the new policy, and we've seen already one memo that shows some friction over this. The Secretary of the Navy, John Phelan, said the policy may be too restrictive, and he points out that as many as a third of officers in training had some involvement with scouting.
Let's emphasize, these are draft documents that you're seeing on a not quite final policy. What's the Pentagon or anybody else saying about the possibility of this?
Yeah, that was what they, the one-liner that they gave us in terms of comment was that they would not comment on, quote, leaked documents that we cannot authenticate and that may be pre-decisional.
Okay.
Scouting America, we also reached out to them. They said they're very proud of their relationship with the military, and they'll continue to support military families no matter what happens.
Graham Smith is with NPR's Investigations Unit. Thanks for the revelations. Really appreciate it.
Good to talk with you, Steve.
We'll keep covering this story.
If you see hundreds of people dressed up as Santa next month, all in one place, there's a good chance you're in the middle of SantaCon. It's an event that happens across the country and even a few places around the world. It's associated with bar crawls now. But Hannah Frischberg from member station WNYC reports on a new documentary about the event's counterculture early days when it was known as Santarchy.
It's 1995. San Francisco, and a group of pranksters called the Cacophony Society are putting on what would become SantaCon. This is tape from a new documentary called SantaCon. The society was dedicated to creating alternative events. They'd accidentally founded what would become Burning Man in 1986. Here's SantaCon founder Rob Schmidt talking with Chris Hackett, organizer of the first New York SantaCon.
So, postcard in my friend's bedroom while making costumes of Santa's playing pool.
If he saw a postcard of the dogs playing pool, this would have been a very different event.
You think it would have been dogs? Dog-a-con? Wouldn't a hit the same? The first event involved about 100 Santas who roved San Francisco, storming a Hyatt Regency hotel, a Macy's, and a Planet Hollywood, where they danced with grandmothers, stole drinks, and inspired giddy shock with their chaos. No one had ever seen so many Santas in one place.
Santa Claus!
Director Seth Porges got the idea for the documentary back in 2021, when he learned a friend was not just an early SantaCon participant, but had a lot of old camcorder footage of it.
And when I saw the footage, I just knew I have to make a movie out of this.
Porges' documentary mostly focuses on the early years, before Schmidt's creation became mostly a day-drinking event. In those days, the event was about going against the grain and making people think, and also having fun. As SantaCon organizer Chris Hackett puts it,
it was kind of like, let's mess with people. Let's really subvert whatever people might think about Santa.
Today, Hackett says even though the event has changed, he still sees SantaCon as one of the only ways to have a big, weird time together.
It just keeps coming back to people are hungry for experience, right? They want to take over the street. They want to do the thing. They want to matter in some way. SantaCon, sadly, seems to be the only thing that's giving them that opportunity.
The documentary SantaCon has not yet been picked up for distribution, but is available at DocNYC through the end of the month. For NPR News, I'm Hannah Frischberg in New York.
This is NPR News.
The global internet is actually powered by hundreds of thin cables along the ocean floor, thanks to one man's quest to create the first transatlantic cable over 100 years ago.
If you look at a present-day cable map of the world, and you look at the 1902 cable map of the world, you will see those cables are on exactly the same routes.
I'm Juana Summers, the origins of today's World Wide Web on All Things Considered from NPR News.
You
can hear All Things Considered starting at 4 o'clock today here on People Powered KAXC. Good morning, I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up in just a few moments, our daily dose of phenology with John Latimer. John looks back at his nature notes for this date, November 25th. Also coming up on the Tuesday morning show, John Latimer will be co-hosting with Heidi Holton, and we'll hear John's latest observations at 7:20. We'll also hear student reports starting at 6:45. We do have a winter storm watch in effect going on from 6 a.m. today until noon tomorrow. 3 to 10 inches of snow possible throughout northern Minnesota during that time. Winds gusting up to 35 miles per hour. Slippery road conditions expected. And snow could be heavy at times today. Highs near 35, breezy north winds. Snow continues overnight with lows in the low 20s. Slight chance of snow before noon tomorrow. Cloudy, highs near 25. Winds gusting from the northwest up to 30 miles per hour. And looking ahead to Thanksgiving Day, mostly cloudy, highs in the low 20s and blustery northwest winds once again. Tickets are now on sale for Home is Where the Heart Is, a benefit for Grace House, Itasca County's only homeless shelter. The event is Thursday, December 4th, but tickets must be purchased before tomorrow at Grand Rapids Super One stores, Timberlake Lodge, or at Grace House. The Salvation Army in Hibbing has a free Thanksgiving meal tomorrow evening, 4 to 6. The event also features games, crafts, and karaoke. And the 16th annual Brainerd Turkey Run is Thanksgiving morning, beginning at 9 from the Brainerd Armory. Proceeds will benefit Shriners Hospitals for Kids. Run or walk 1 mile or 5 kilometers. Find more info and register at BrainerdTurkeyRun.com. If you have events to share with our listeners, send them by email, psa@kaxc.org. Here is John Latimer.
On today's date, November 25th, 1994, I'm skating on Crooked Lake, and the ice is clear, free of snow, about 3 inches thick, and smooth as a sheet of glass. I couldn't ask for better skating conditions. And while I'm zipping along on the ice, I'm abruptly halted by the sight of a giant water beetle. You all know this guy. Sometimes called the toe biter, sometimes called the electric light bug. It's a 3-inch long beetle that is unmistakable for anybody who's maybe attended a late night football game in the fall and had one drop into their lap, or maybe been swimming about in a lake in the summertime and have come across this giant insect. This one is truly noteworthy and noticeable, but this one was crawling along on the underside of the ice, trailing a little bubble attached to the back of its abdomen, which I suspect was an oxygen bubble that it would use if need be, probably going from air bubble to air bubble underneath the ice and finding its way around. It will spend the winter in the ice and probably emerge in the springtime, ready to bite your toe, perhaps.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Focus Features, presenting Hamnet, directed by Chloe Zhao, starring Jesse Buckley and Paul Mescal, in select theaters Wednesday, everywhere December 5th. From Capital One, offering their dining and entertainment card, Saver. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. We have a follow-up conversation with Spencer Cox. He's the governor of Utah, where the activist Charlie Kirk was murdered in September.
Ladies and gentlemen, I get the microphone, so...
Cox gave an update on the investigation and then said a little more.
Over the last 48 hours, I have been as angry as I have ever been. As sad as I have ever been.
He urged Americans to reflect on the path they've been following.
And I would encourage people to log off, turn off, touch grass, hug a family member, go out and do good in your community.
His words provoked a powerful reaction then. So how does he think Americans are responding now? We met with Cox during an event that's on brand for him, a bipartisan meeting of the Western Governors Association in Arizona. For years, he has championed political civility, or as he puts it, disagreeing better.
We have to decide, is this an off-ramp? Are we going to take an off-ramp, or are we going to continue to hate each other and foment that type of tribalism that leads to these very dark deeds and evil moments?
Have you seen any signs that anybody's taking the off-ramp?
Yeah, I actually have. I was shocked at the response from that moment. But here we are now months later, and the response continues to be overwhelmingly positive, hearing it from all corners of the nation of people who are desperate for something different.
Spencer Cox is 50. He's from a small town in Utah and has a self-effacing style. During our video interview, somebody said I had a hair out of place, and he referred to his own lack of hair. It's all good.
You know, Steve, some of us don't have that problem. I mean, there are some downsides for sure, but there are a few benefits I'd like to point out.
He's a conservative governor who has also embraced pragmatism, and he quoted a constitutional scholar to explain why.
We keep thinking if we just win this election, we'll never have to work with those people. And the Constitution, as Yuval Levin writes so eloquently, says that we'll always have to work with those people. That's how this gets done. We have to build coalitions.
In your speech after the assassination, you also said there is one person responsible for this act. What were you trying to say?
Look, it's very easy to demonize entire groups of people, but I don't think that's a long-term strategy. I don't think it's particularly effective, and it also happens to not be true. Every single Democrat I know that I talked to about this was just appalled by what happened. I think it's important in my faith, we believe in agency. We believe that we are responsible for our own decisions and that other people aren't responsible for those. And so to try to attack an entire group of people or an ideology because of one person isn't right and isn't fair, and that's what I was trying to explain.
What did you think about in the days afterward when the administration said they were going to investigate liberal groups for encouraging violence, or however they would phrase it?
Sure. Look, if there are groups out there that are encouraging that type of violence, then we should hold them accountable. But again, for me, it's just important that we focus on who did this, holding that person accountable, and then doing what we can to make sure that it doesn't happen again.
Some people will know you did not vote for the president in 2016, did not vote for him in 2020, and then endorsed him in 2024.
Correct.
In a way that's particularly meaningful for our discussion. If I can summarize,
please. Yeah.
After the assassination attempt in Butler, Pennsylvania, you said the president's survival was a miracle and spoke to him directly and said, only you can unify the country now. Has he?
I think if you were to ask him that question, he would say no. I don't think that's happened. And yet, I have an opportunity to have a relationship with the president. And I think that's very important to me. It's very important to Utahns. I will tell you that after that press conference that you referred to earlier, he was one of the first people to call me. He told me how much he appreciated that press conference, especially the part at the end, which was the part that you and I are talking about.
Yeah.
Now, again, he hasn't modeled that, and he sees the world a little differently than I do. But at least I can have a conversation with him, and at least he's willing. Again, he appreciated what I said, and that meant something.
The difference in the worldview is that he sees his political adversaries as enemies.
There was this interesting moment in the Charlie Kirk Memorial. You heard Erica Kirk forgive the shooter. One of the most powerful, most Christian moments I had ever experienced. And then there's this very revealing moment, the president, and he got panned for this. I actually give him credit for it, where he said, Charlie's always trying to get me to forgive my enemies. And he said, I just can't do that.
I hate my opponent, and I don't want the best for them. I'm sorry.
I appreciated his honesty in that moment.
you appreciated that he said it.
Yeah, yeah.
And, not that and you I think it's the right way to be.
I appreciate that he owned it, and he would tell you if you were sitting here today that he and I disagree on that point. I believe that we are commanded to forgive our enemies, that it's part of our formation of who we are. It doesn't mean that they shouldn't be held accountable,
yeah.
But it does mean that for our own sake, it's something that we have to do.
Because you say we are commanded, I want to ask, how much does your faith inform your politics?
My faith is core to my politics. I think we make a mistake in this country. We talk about a separation of church and state, which is very important, and I believe in that. I believe that that was mostly intended for government not to interfere with religion institutions. It doesn't mean we have to separate our faith from our personhood in public service or in any other way. So when Jesus tells me, I think this is the hardest commandment in all of Christianity. It's not just that we're supposed to forgive our enemies, but it's to love our enemies and to do good to them who hate us and despitefully use us.
Spencer Cox says this fits in well with his duties as governor when he must serve even those who voted against him. In the months since Kirk's assassination, Cox has faced some criticism, including from the political right. I'm thinking of a particular event. It was the TPUSA, Turning Point USA event, the first one after Kirk's assassination. You appeared, you were introduced, not all, but some of the audience booed.
Sure.
We had several speaking events that day, and we...
What do you think that booing represents?
Well, I love that we live in a country where you can do that. That's really important. And I think that's what Charlie stood for as well. We should go into places where maybe people disagree with us.
In 2022, Kirk called on Republicans to expel Cox from the party for vetoing a bill banning trans athletes from girls' sports. That's why Cox was booed at that event. Although when he explained his reasons, the crowd applauded.
I wish I would have had an opportunity to talk to Charlie about that. I never got that opportunity. But again, when I explained that to the crowd, I think their position changed.
Spencer Cox says it's hard to talk through issues when politics becomes a loyalty test, a test of faith.
We're looking for tribes somewhere, and we're finding that in politics. Politics is replacing religion. You know, I always like to say if I don't have any real friends, at least we can hate the same people together on Facebook or TikTok. And that's no replacement for true conversation. And I think that's dangerous. And that leads to things like Charlie Kirk getting assassinated.
Governor Cox, it's a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Steve.
He's the governor of Utah and spoke with us at a meeting of the Western Governors Association. We also talked about energy, AI, and much more. And the full video is at the NPR app and on YouTube. This is NPR News.
I found a song.
So I found KAXE when I was in college here in Bemidji. I actually can remember being at the stoplights at Dave's Pizza, just jumping radio stations, and it must have been, I want to say it was the Jayhawks, maybe Wilco was on the radio, and it floored me. I was like, wait, how am I hearing this in Bemidji, in northern Minnesota? I thought I had to be in the Twin Cities to get this stuff.
Mark is a member of KAXE. We are people powered. The music that you hear is not chosen by the government or an algorithm or a corporation. It's chosen by your friends and neighbors. Over 70 hours a week is produced by local volunteers. Support the people of northern Minnesota and KAXE with your donation now. Go to KAXE.org.
Thank you for listening to the Tuesday Morning Show on People Powered KAXE. Good morning, I'm Jennifer Barr. We do have a winter storm watch in effect until noon tomorrow, and we can expect 3 to 10 inches of snow. Looks like higher snow amounts on the Iron Range, less in northwestern Minnesota. Winds will be gusting up to 35 miles per hour. Slippery road conditions are expected, so be very careful. We can expect heavy snow at times today, highs near 35 and breezy north wind. Snow continues tonight, lows in the low 20s, and slight chance of snow before noon tomorrow. Cloudy, highs near 25. Once again, northwest winds up to 30 miles per hour. Looking ahead to Thanksgiving Day, mostly cloudy, highs in the low 20s, and once again, blustery northwest wind. United Way of Northeastern Minnesota invites high school seniors to write an essay on the biggest need you see in your community and your ideas to address that need. Open to those in Coochiching and Lake of the Woods County, plus the entire Iron Range. Find more at UnitedWayNEMN.org. The deadline is January 1st. Minnesota State Parks offer free admission this Friday. Get out and explore your favorite park or find somewhere new. The Armory Arts and Event Center in Park Rapids presents A Very Good Christmas Carol, a humorous take on Dickens, with three ghosts, two actors, and one helpful audience. There are free performances Friday, 7 o'clock, Saturday at 2.
NPR comes from this station and from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. From BritBox, committed to helping viewers to see it differently with British TV, with new original series like Code of Silence, about a deaf woman recruited as a lip reader in a high-stakes police investigation. Streaming at BritBox.com. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. A new poll shows President Trump's standing among Latinos is evaporating. The Pew Research Center has a new analysis from surveys of more than 5,000 people. It found, among other things, heavy disapproval of the president among Latinos on the economy and on deportations, among other things. That's a huge reversal for Trump, who did better with Latinos in 2024 than any other Republican presidential candidate in history. NPR's senior political editor and correspondent Domenico Montanaro has dug into the numbers. Domenico, good morning.
Hey, good morning, Steve.
Okay, what are the numbers?
Well, you know, 70% of Latinos surveyed say that they disapprove of the job Trump is doing. And remember, this is someone who won almost half of Latinos who voted in 2024. You know, he's also down 12 points with Latinos who voted for him. You know, when he came into office, they had a 93% approval of him. Now that's down to 81%. And that's of those who voted. Non-voters who are eligible to vote give him just a 27% approval rating. That's down 15 points from when he was sworn in for his second term. So generally what we're seeing is that a lot of Latinos gave Trump a chance but are now souring on it.
This is really interesting because just a few months ago, Republicans were thinking and talking about realigning the parties in this way. What's causing their decline?
Yeah, I feel like a broken record, but it's the two issues that we've been talking about throughout Trump's second term, affordability and immigration. You know, the economy, specifically the cost of living, was the number one issue for Latino voters in the 2024 presidential election. It's why so many crossed over to vote for Trump. But they're not feeling great about Trump's economy. 4 in 5 view it negatively. 61% say Trump's economic policies have made conditions worse. Just 15% say that they've made things better. And this is a real issue hitting home for a lot of people. Half of Latinos surveyed say that in the past year, they've struggled to afford food, housing, or medical care.
Let me bring up immigration, because we've been reminded that Latinos don't just care about immigration. Interviews over the past couple of years have shown us, we've heard on the program, some people who are Latino don't like illegal immigration, feel they came here legally, resent the people who skip the line as they see it. So there was room for Trump, but now they're seeing how he is enacting his immigration ideas. What's the poll finding about the response?
Yeah, and again, cost of living is the top issue, but 2/3 disapprove of Trump's approach to immigration. Most importantly, 71% say that he's doing too much when it comes to deportations. You know, that's up 15 points from March. And it's really quite stunning here that half also say that they're worried that they, a close friend, or a family member might be deported. That's up sharply since Trump started his second term. And many Latinos are left questioning where they fit in the American story right now. 55% say that they have serious concerns about their place in the country. 1 in 3 say that they've thought about leaving the country in the last 6 months.
Wow.
Whether it's because of politics, which was the plurality, or because of the cost of living. It's really remarkable considering America's long been seen as a destination to work and create a new life for a family.
I want to be clear. These people thinking about leaving the country, these are citizens who are voters, right?
Yeah.
Okay. What does this mean for Trump and Republicans for next year?
I think that it means for either party, Latinos are not a guaranteed vote. I mean, a lot of Hispanic voters felt for a long time that the Democrats took them for granted, but many are certainly feeling estranged from the Republican Party. And with Trump in charge and the cost of living being what it is and the way deportations are being conducted, it looks worse for the GOP. 4 in 5 say Trump's policies have been harmful to Latinos. Even a third of those who voted for him say that.
NPR's Domenico Montanaro, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
And this is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin.
Well, I've got two brothers and they're in the Marines.
This is Drew Miller from Boiled in Lead urging you to support KAXE and KBXE. Community radio is a lifeline for culture, and these days it's under threat. If you enjoy it, you need to help pay for it because nobody else is going to do it except for you. Please support KAXE and the Summer Pledge Drive.
Make a donation now by visiting our website, kaxe.org, and clicking the word donate, or text donate to 218-326-1234.
Climbing up that old gallows ladder, cried out so gaily for his high white cap and feather. I've always been a lively lad, never
Talking turkey on Thanksgiving inflation.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Odoo, offering software that provides building blocks for creating a custom software suite. Odoo, what businesses need. And by Mercury. Mercury brings together banking, credit cards, invoicing, and more to help entrepreneurs manage their finances. Learn more at mercury.com.
I'm David Brancaccio in Los Angeles. Good morning. We are leading with the politics of what we have to pay for the Thanksgiving meal. Before we go any further, let's be clear. No one needs to tell you if your grocery bill is getting higher or lower. We're all there at the supermarket scanner. We know what we're buying and if it's up or down. That said, my colleague Kimberly Adams reports now on the dueling statistics and narratives on this.
When it comes to the cost of Thanksgiving,
so this year, we see that Thanksgiving dinner is going to be less expensive.
Our numbers show that it's going to be pretty close to the same or a little bit up.
We find that the typical Thanksgiving meal will run people about 10% more this year.
That's Faith Parham at the American Farm Bureau, Justin Cook at Deloitte, and Elizabeth Pancotti at the economic think tank Groundwork Collaborative. Here's the thing. Food prices overall are up. Here's the Farm Bureau's Faith Parham again.
For vegetables specifically, our veggie tray was up more than 61% and sweet potatoes were up 37%.
So some Thanksgiving baskets replace fresh vegetables with frozen, drop the dessert, use more generic brands. And some stores are willing to take a hit on the turkey, says Elizabeth Pancotti at Groundwork Collaborative.
They can put those prices in the paper or in online advertisements to get you in the door. And then they know that you will buy the pumpkin pie filling and the green beans and the stuffing.
Regardless, family budgets are tight this holiday season. So says Justin Cook at Deloitte.
They may eat a less fancy meal, or some families are actually going to invite fewer guests, kind of downsizing the meal itself as a way to save money.
And, says Cook, if you're going to be a guest, it's more important than ever to contribute to the cause. Cook says the average guest will spend about $47 to add to the spread. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Kimberly, who is a wonderful host herself.
Let's check the markets. After the NASDAQ closed up 2.7% yesterday as the technology and AI exuberance put in one more day, this morning NASDAQ futures are down slightly, 0.4%. S&P futures are down 0.2% now. Dow futures are down 0.8%. The 10-year interest rate is down a sliver, pushing up the yield to 4.02%.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Schwab. Schwab knows that investors want control of their financial future. That's why when it comes to wealth management, Schwab is dedicated to giving investors more choices. More at schwab.com. And by the United States Postal Service, offering holiday stamps for purchase at over 40,000 supermarkets and drugstores, and at wholesale clubs Costco, Walmart, Sam's Club, and BJ's.
There are published reports that we could get an announcement from the White House someday soon revealing how the administration plans to deal with high medical costs and expiring government subsidies for health insurance. Now, without those subsidies, which are set to expire at the end of this year in just over 5 weeks, many who buy Affordable Care Act medical plans would see their premiums double, triple, quadruple. But even people who haven't relied on tax credits for health insurance are seeing their premiums for ACA coverage go up next year, about 26% on average. Marketplace's Samantha Fields looked into why that's happening.
This year, Kelly Williams and her husband have been paying about $2,000 a month without subsidies for health insurance through the marketplace for them and their two kids. Next year, that same bronze plan will cost them about $3,300 a month, $40,000 for the year.
So I'm a little bit paralyzed because obviously I really don't want to spend $40,000 on health insurance, but I also don't want to choose a bad plan or choose the wrong plan.
Williams and her husband own a commercial printing business in rural Oklahoma, and their kids are in college. They don't go to the doctor much or take many prescriptions, but she says going without insurance doesn't feel like an option.
With kids, you worry most about accidents, and you're like, what if somebody's in a horrible car wreck and you have just a $500,000 hospital bill or something?
She knew going into open enrollment this year that her family's premium would probably be going up.
Once the news came that there were going to be the cuts to Medicaid and the cuts to the subsidies, I knew that you could not take that much money out of the healthcare market and not have it affect everybody.
She's right. Sabrina Corlett at Georgetown Center on Health Insurance Reforms says that's one of the main reasons premiums are going up. Because if the enhanced subsidies do expire, lots of young, healthy people are likely to drop coverage because it's too expensive.
And when insurance companies anticipate a smaller, sicker pool of people that they're going to have to cover, they will increase their premiums.
The average increase for marketplace plans for next year is about 26%. Matthew Fiedler at the Brookings Institution says that's big, especially after several years of premiums being relatively stable.
Enhanced subsidies took effect in 2021. The market's grown a lot, and a lot of the people who came into the market were pretty healthy. So that provided a source of downward pressure on premium growth. Now we're seeing that process go into reverse.
During the height of the pandemic, fewer people were going to doctors, too, delaying non-urgent care, which kept costs down for insurance companies. But these days,
we've seen insurers talking about people using more hospital care, people going to the doctor more, people filling more prescriptions,
which increases insurers' costs and pushes up premiums. There's also inflation, which Fiedler says took longer to hit healthcare than other parts of the economy. It's an expensive combination. Kelly Williams is still trying to figure out what to do for her family in rural Oklahoma. Right now, they have a bronze plan with a low deductible.
I think we're probably going to have to go with a higher deductible plan to ease the financial burden of it.
Even with a higher deductible, insurance for the four of them will cost about $3,000 a month.
It absolutely dwarfs our mortgage,
which is $1,200 all in. It's crushing, Williams says, but she knows her family's lucky they can make it work. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
It Takes a Village. Our producers are Tamar Fagan, Ashley Rodriguez, Ariana Rosas, and Erica Soderstrom. Our senior producer is Alex Schroeder. Our supervising senior producer is Meredith Gerritsen-Morby. In Los Angeles, I'm David Brancaccio. It's the Marketplace Morning Report. APM, American Public Media.
It's a minute before 6 o'clock. Thank you for listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We're people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. You can join us at KAXE.org. I'm Jennifer Barr. Thanks so much for tuning in to the Tuesday morning show. We'll have more ahead for Morning Edition, 6:30. Heidi Holton and John Latimer, your host. We'll hear student phonology talkbacks at 6:45. We can expect winter weather today. Snow heavy at times, highs near 35. Breezy north wind gusting up to 35 miles per hour. Between today and tomorrow, we can expect 3 to 10 inches of snow, depending on where you are. Our lows overnight in the low 20s, and for tomorrow, slight chance of snow before noon, then cloudy, highs near 20.